4. I see you coming. Loneliness. They tried to explain for a while. In the end, because she could not, in fact, take in what they were saying, they just had the suits show her the footage they had. Documentation of the last days of human civilization. In the world outside Admiral Huntsey Island, there had been a terrible plague. News services called it pigeon flu, because for a while they thought that the rapid spread of the illness was caused by pigeons. There was a series of photographs from Paris of local militia using flamethrowers against the pigeons. In the images, the birds were trying to fly, their wings on fire. They looked like they were screaming gouts of flame. None of these measures helped. No warning had come through in advance. The flu had a silent incubation period of 17 days, and then became deadly almost at once. The first symptom could be coughing up huge quantities of blood, followed by heart failure. Within days, people were remembering COVID-19 as a kind plague. It had spared the children. Its death toll had been less than 1%. It did not successfully spread via minute quantities of virus on letters or packages. The pigeon flu was not so kind. There had been preparations after COVID-19 for a similar plague. Countries were faster to quarantine, faster to test, faster to close schools. But COVID had left them vulnerable in a different way. They thought they knew how to act, that they had understood the limits and tolerances of the thing. People went into lockdown easily enough, but deliveries continued. Too late. They thought they knew how it would happen, and that this time they would do it properly. But it came differently this time, as disaster always does. It was too deadly and too quick. It killed the young traveling from house to house on their bicycles, and not the old, hunkered down at home. It was airborne, but most of all, it survived on paper packaging for more than 98 hours. Delivery drivers brought it with them. And then there was panic and mistrust, and then there were riots and guns, and then. The disease had erupted in more than 70 significant population centers on all continents almost simultaneously. Lagos in Nigeria, a city with a very young population, was the first to declare itself a no-go zone. It evacuated the remainder of its citizens to the countryside and erected concrete blocks across all roads into the city. It was not enough. The living did not suffice to bury the dead. The suits had managed to scour Fantail and Medlar for early evidence of what was happening before the military cut off satellite communications for civilians. Shun watched a handheld video from Venezuela of two teenage kids playing guitars in unison in a bedroom, a boy and a girl, looking at each other, smiling as they picked out a version of Te veo venir soledad. The girl started to cough halfway through the second chorus. The cough became a spray of blood from the back of her throat, red and lurid, onto the wall. Her friend stopped playing. Whoever was holding the phone put it down, and the camera showed the cracked plaster ceiling. Two boys were calling the girl's name. The coughing continued, soggy, full of liquid, and the kids called for help. It took more than 8 minutes for one of them to pick up the phone. 3 seconds of a boy's face, terrified and confused, and then it ended. In Auckland, two elderly women took a photograph of themselves against stone blue mountains, clouds fogging the more distant peaks. Behind them, in a narrow street, a man was coughing blood against a white wall. There were more photographs and short pieces of video like this. A woman dancing on a London underground train, to her left and half cut off, a girl in school uniform coughing into a soaked red fistful of tissue. A man in Senegal filming his friend's reaction to a hat trick goal in the 89th minute, the friend so excited he couldn't catch his breath, and then coughing, and then blood. Before long, early background evidence wasn't needed anymore. By 72 hours in, images and videos, grainy as they were, told the story better than news reports. The suits had managed brief data grabs from fragmented commercial satellite links. "We thought of sending details of our location," Ellen said, as if she were addressing a stockholder meeting. But it's too hard to control who can read the information in these scenarios, and we didn't want visitors. The images were pixelated, the words brief and in some cases misspelled. The video files were corrupted with data artifacts clouding the screen. Scenery merged with human faces, shadows turning into animals as the AI tried to reconstruct detail. In New York City, four bodies were piled on top of one another in a hospital corridor covered in sheets. An orderly was pointing a handgun at the door. The photograph didn't show who or what was coming. Her eyes were closed, her expression almost serene except for the gritted jaw. This photograph was the last moment of something. Whatever came after it would scarcely be occurring to the same people as the days and weeks and decades before. On the long platform at Bologna Central train station, a train was passing through on its way to Paris. People clambered on one another's backs, trying to find purchase on the slow-moving train. Some had climbed up onto the decorated clock, trying to swing onto the train. There happened to be two photographs from this one event, or perhaps there had been many trains passing through Bologna toward Paris, and it was the same story with each one. The second photograph the suits had found was from inside the train. Two children stood with their hands pressed against the glass as the people on the platform tried to kick in the window as it passed. In the photograph, one child, a little boy, was looking back at his father with a dread that went beyond children's tears. It was a look of unmitigated despair and terror. In Smolensk, a reactor had been encased in a mountain of concrete, but, Chun Sut said in a matter-of-fact tone as she watched, radioactive material may still be released into the atmosphere. It would be advisable to wear your suit whenever you can. A cloud of radiation may rain poison into the dark soil at any time. The younger the news, the grimmer it was. The reports that three very senior technology CEOs had vanished had been rapidly superseded by events. After the revelation that delivery drivers were in effect bringing the virus from home to home, there were many social media posts telling Zimri Nomic to go fuck himself. There was a news article mentioning in passing that several empty bunkers in New Zealand had been raided by the military, sequestering stockpiles to distribute to citizens.
We wrote our own software on the plane, said Zimri with a certain quiet pride, to confirm what Augur was telling us.
Anvil had access to information beyond anything governments and journalists could hope for. Logistics patterns, purchasing decisions, data access needs, and yes, spyware in Anvil home hubs and various web service products. On the private jet, Zimri had correlated data from Anvil's many armed logistics businesses with non-uploaded video from Fantail and Medlar phones, which Fantail and Medlar had access to for certain emergency situations.
There was no track and trace scenario, Zimri said. It moved too quickly. Originated in South America, possibly Chile, where the earliest cases were covered up, but spread too fast for us to do anything about. By the time Augur alerted us, Anvil data was already showing the same cluster of symptoms in Australia, Brazil, Japan, and Indonesia.
We would have alerted the WHO, Ellen chimed in, if we'd reached our destination successfully. Lenk Skatlish was sitting this conversation out, staring up at the sheltering trees, neither confirming nor denying. I'm saying we would have, said Ellen, but the others did not reply.
It kills 50% of infected people, said Zimri, in a tone as flat as the affectless blue sky. And that's if they can be cared for, if they have anti-inflammatories, if they can be somewhere warm and dry with adequate clean water. There was no time to develop a vaccine or other treatments before world infrastructure collapsed. They're not going to be able to do it now. It's just going to rip through until at least half of them are dead.
Ellen said, it would have been great if Augur had told us sooner. Zimri said,
it told us sooner than anyone else in the world.
There must be other individual survivors, some with natural immunity, some recovered, battling to find fresh water and food, fighting against the tide of destruction. But as far as they could tell, no large enclaves had been able to hold out against the assault. It was a black swan event. A previously only mildly dangerous virus suddenly became both much more infectious and much more deadly in one mutagenic leap. It never happens, except when it does. It was already happening when Shun got into the car in Prince Rupert, they explained. It had been happening before Zimri Nomik and Lank Sketlish and Ellen Bywater and their children and trusted friends and colleagues had boarded their private jets bound for their secret bunkers. It had happened swiftly and without mercy. The world that they knew was gone, as suddenly, completely, and irretrievably as if it had sunk beneath the glass-green ocean. "Okay," said Shun, and she was very aware of her breathing, very aware of the thick blood pounding through skin tubes inside her body, the heaviness of this flesh.
"So are we just staying here forever?"
Ellen and Zimri exchanged a glance. Ellen said, "We are going to leave at some point. I mean, we weren't supposed to be here. I have a bunker in New Zealand. Oh, it's beautiful. My kids are there, and Banda and Arthur from Medlar and their families, some other people. I'm sure we can find room for you when transport is arranged. And it's not the perfect solution to all this, but honestly, I think we can make a great life there." Zimri said,
"There was a problem with our plane. It crashed. We were just supposed to be heading for a staging post. We were lucky we were within reach of here. I mean, if we'd gone down in the ocean, we'd be dead."
Lank Sketlish let out a long sigh that turned into a bellow.
"Tell her the fucking truth," he said. "The truth. We owe her that, at least. We're not getting out of here. We are on an island. We have no boat. There are no comms. No one is coming for us. No one knows we are here. The world outside is not equipped to come look for us anyway. The world is gone and we are here, and unless something changes in an unprecedented way, we are stuck here. Forever."
Chun Sut said, "This is going to take some adjusting to. All your feelings are okay. A period of grief is to be expected. Your survival suit is equipped with a range of light reading material and classic novels. You could read 50 Shades of Grey, Right Ho, Jeeves, The Poisonwood Bible, The Runaway Jury, Station 11, Lord of the Flies, The Tale of Sinui, And Then There Were None, The Bluest Eye, Oryx and Crake, The Road, The Remains of the Day."
Jin thought, this is impossible. She tried to make herself believe it, to think through the loss until something snagged on her inside, something that felt real. "If I don't try to take in what they're telling me, this is not going to go well. Remember Hong Kong," she said to herself. "Remember how you had to convince yourself the building was really gone. Even though you saw it, a part of you thought it must be a mistake." She thought, somewhere in the world, it is snowing right now. Thick flakes falling, soft and dense, almost heavy, wet enough to melt, but not quite. Freezing again into snow that crunches as you walk on it, and your boots collapse through the crisp layers like a millefeuille pastry, and children have to lift their legs out for each step. She said to herself, "I will never see it again.